So, if we look at the history of the spiritual traditions of Asia, and especially India, because the Buddhism, which became very prominent, of course, throughout Asia, came from India. So, in looking at the history, going back to the earliest times, the history of spirituality, the history of spiritual culture and expression in South Asia, we find that one of the most important concepts, fundamental concept, and something which was most debated is language, the role of language. And I think we can, by a little bit of thought, we can see why language was really at the center of the history of spirituality in South Asia and the various debates that arose there. Because it is a tradition, a history, which is full of very serious and very profound debate and discussion on various spiritual paths. The reason language is so important, I could say for two reasons. There were two facts about spirituality in India which inevitably which came into conflict and tension, and I'll explain those two facts. The first fact is that if we go back to the earliest, practically the earliest spiritual literature on earth, in the Sanskrit language, we find that speech is considered to be, first of all, goddess, and speech is considered to be divine. The Sanskrit word for speech is vach or vak, of course, from which we get our English word vocal and voice and so on. So the Vedas themselves, and the word Veda means knowledge. So it's interesting, it's like the word Bible means book. So Veda means knowledge. And from the Sanskrit root, wit, from which we have the English word wit. And all kinds of other Indo-European words like the German wissen and the word vision, video, and so on, the Latin vedere, to see. So Veda means knowledge, and of course the Vedas were works that were composed in language. And because you have the sacred literature, composed in language, therefore language was seen as originally divine. And it's actually the gift of language that really allows human beings to think, if you think about it. We think, in a sense, verbally. We conceive of things. We express ourselves. We understand other people through language. And so language, and of course, human beings, although other animals have language, there's something uniquely sophisticated about human language when it's done seriously, which isn't so much, it isn't done so seriously anymore. But anyway, in fact, there's a statement in the Rig Veda, the oldest Sanskrit literature, that there are four parts of speech. This is a famous statement from the oldest Sanskrit literature, the Rig Veda. There are four parts of speech, and human beings only know one of these parts, and the gods know the three other parts. And there's even language which the gods don't know. Now, that's one fact. One fact is from the earliest Sanskrit, Vedic, Indian, yoga history, language was seen as extremely important at the center of human culture and at the center of human spiritual culture and expression. Now, something happened, and that is around, let's say, 2,500 years ago, and this is a very standard version of the history of India that I'm giving you now. This is not an esoteric insight I have. Around 2,500 years ago, there arose in India various groups of people who, in their own ways, wanted to renounce the material world. Now, one of these groups, let's say around 2,600 years ago, it arose was a group which today is called the Jains, J-A-I-N, which still a religion which still exists in India. And shortly after the Jains, of course, you had a much more famous figure, Buddha. You had Mahavira among the Jains, and of course, tracing back their lineage to earlier people, but basically the first more or less historical figure is Mahavira. Then you have Buddha himself appearing approximately 2,500 years ago. Now, according to most historians of India, these, let's say the Jains, Mahavira, Buddha, they were building on something that was already there. There was already a tradition which had arisen in India called the Shramana tradition. Shramana in Sanskrit basically means, literally sort of knocking yourself out. And it was working very hard to renounce the world. And so you had these people who would leave the cities, who would sort of wander off into the forest. Obviously India was, back then, was not deforested the way it is today. And there was a large part of India was wilderness. And people would leave the cities where they had all the comforts of life and so on, and where their family was living, and they would just go off into the wilderness. And this, so you have this approach of getting away from ordinary human civilization, getting away from the entanglements, the attachments, going out into nature, performing austerities, which in Sanskrit are called tapas or tapasya, literally kind of burning, like the fire of ordeal, and meditating, and so on. And there were different approaches to this. So Buddha and Mahavira from the Jains were building upon something which was already in vogue among certain spiritual seekers in India. Now getting back to language, what does this have to do with language? This idea that the world is illusory, that it's sort of infectious, it's sort of radioactive in the sense that if you live a normal life in the world, you'll become attached to things, and the more you become attached, the more you'll suffer. This is just Buddhism 1A, of course. And so we want to free ourselves from these attachments. And the best thing is get away from it all, go out to the wilderness. In fact, they were called Prabrajakas, or literally the departers, people that just get away from it all. Now, here's the issue with language. If your idea is to give up the world, if the world is somehow illusory, it's temporary, and whatever you become attached to in this world leads to suffering, then it's very easy for people in that frame of mind to think, well, what about language? Isn't language part of the world? Isn't language just another material thing? Because in one sense, there is certainly a physical aspect to language. We either speak it, of course you can always think language, but then of course there are certain brain patterns and all that. But when you speak language, we have a vocal apparatus, and we can study scientifically, phonology and phonetics, exactly how we produce meaningful sound. And when we write language, then we also have a physical artifact. We have a visible language and so on. So, it's nice music. Oh, the cell phone announcement. You all know what to do, right? So, for those of you who just came in, we're talking about language. So language, the role of language really became a flashpoint in the sense of, in what sense is the world unreal? In what sense is the world illusory? And is the world hopeless? Is there some way that you can be spiritual in the world? Is there some way the world can be spiritualized? Or is it just a write-off? It's just damage control, just let go of it, get away. And it also has to do with what is the goal of meditation and spirituality. It's like whatever your path is, when all the dust clears and you made it, you're enlightened, your ultimate spiritual woo-hoo moment. What are you? And who are you? What does liberation look like? Now, if there's some kind of personal liberation, then of course, in your enlightened state, you can go on talking to other enlightened people. Or you can even talk to unenlightened people. But if the ultimate stage of enlightenment and liberation is something which radically rejects the world, that the world is actually has nothing to do with enlightenment, and the more you get away from the world, the more you reject it, the more enlightened you are, then language is probably going to go down the drain with the rest of the material grime. And you're going to, your meditation's like this big cosmic soap pad. And so really, the debates, and there were very powerful debates between Buddhists and people from the traditional yoga paths and so on. They weren't simply, they weren't united as they are now in America in their displeasure with fanatical Middle Eastern religions. Well, I mean, religions that came from the Middle East. So there were these really powerful debates that went on back then, and to some extent still do. So what I would like to say about language, and I'll, truth, I'll be very forthcoming to tell you exactly where I stand. My view is, and not simply doctrinally, because I joined something that, and the thing I joined requires me to say something. But in my own philosophical conviction and my own experiential conviction, based on having, well, since I was 20 years old, been a, I guess you could say, a strict practitioner of Bhakti Yoga, my own experiential and philosophical, spiritual and intellectual conviction is that the world is not merely evil. The world is not merely evil. The world is not just a write-off. And things like falling in love, seeing beauty in other people, beauty in nature, the beauty of words, the beauty of sound ratios, which is a way of saying music, melody and so on. The beauty of music, the beauty of dance, the beauty of all kinds of arts, the beauty of, and ultimately the beauty of people, because actually it's people that make art. Even when we talk about the universe as art, and you can really talk about the universe as art, I'm sure you must have seen the blow-up pictures of snowflakes and water crystals and so on. I mean, basically, you can look anywhere in the universe if you look closely enough, and you'll find fantastic art. And so, that's my own conviction. The universe is not merely bad and evil and radioactive and something to be given up. And the same is true for our personal freedom. Same is true for, as individuals, so to, existentially, so to speak, in business for ourselves, as individuals, we actually have the possibility of freedom. And not merely political freedom or economic freedom, which are certainly not bad, but freedom of consciousness. Because, as we know, we can be, even in a libertarian society, which has a very radical degree of political and social freedom, but if we are deeply attached to material things, if I'm a very greedy, lusty, vain thing, then I'm going to have almost no psychological freedom. We have the power in any political or economic situation to completely enslave ourselves. So, in that sense, if you look at Buddhism, if you look at the yoga tradition, the Yoga Sutras, the Bhagavad Gita, and so on, and many other traditions in India, you go down a whole list of them, you'll find there is actually a broad agreement on the problem in very general terms. The problem is that people are not paying attention to their enlightenment. The problem is that we are trying to exploit this world, and it's a real tar baby. In the act of trying to exploit the material world, we're getting stuck in it. And the more we try to enjoy it, the more we get stuck, and the more we suffer. So there's very wide agreement on that. But then when you go further, but why is this happening? Why is there a world at all? And how do you get unstuck? And is there a way to be in the world where you don't get stuck and yet you appreciate the world? And you appreciate yourself as a free individual. And so, and then language, of course, the power of language. I'm going to be teaching all these things actually in August at the University of Florida. And I don't want to sound sectarian, but the things I'm saying are really, they're philosophical. It's not like a religious argument. For me, it's a philosophical argument. I remember that in terms of language, when I was a kid and going to school at Berkeley, UC Berkeley, of course, I didn't think I was a kid then. I thought I was very mature and wise. But I went back years later and read the stuff I wrote. It definitely proved in scientific theory that young males, you know, their heads don't solidify until a certain age. Anyway, despite my somewhat fogged in state of consciousness, I do remember taking a course in contemporary German literature at Berkeley, and the professor was a young guy who was pretty sharp, a German. He was a young German scholar, and he was critiquing Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse. And I still remember it because I knew nothing really about India or anything about this stuff. And he was being sort of facetious or sarcastic, and he was saying that on page such and such of this book, Hesse says that the truth cannot be spoken in words, and he says this again on this page, and he says it again with words on that page. And so, again, as a philosophical observation concerning language, not as a religious claim, but just philosophically, my own study of certain Buddhist philosophers. And I should mention, by the way, just as you may know, in the study of the history of the Jesus movement, which at a certain point, long after Jesus was gone, came to be called Christianity. In the history of that movement, it has occurred to most people that have studied it, even very faithful, devout followers of Jesus, but those who have seriously studied it, it has occurred to most of them that there is a very serious issue about the historical Jesus, like who was the real historical Jesus, and to what extent do these biographies, or these texts that claim to be biographies, to what extent are they actually revealing the historical Jesus, the person that was really there? And to some extent, I think, even very devout scholars who really are devoted to Jesus, I think practically all of them admit there was a real drift. I won't go into all the historical details because it's not the topic here, but you take this very impressive figure of Jesus of Nazareth, I mean, someone I consider to be a very, very impressive figure, and then for various historical reasons, like the fact that it was a big telephone game, no one wrote anything down for about 30 years, you get this drift, and then you get this process of creating doctrines, and you get this acknowledgement, even in the book of John, chapter 14, that doctrine is being actively created, where the Greek-speaking Jesus, after the fact, is quoted in a book written in Western Turkey, more than a generation after Jesus. Jesus is quoted as saying that people, that you're going to hear a lot of doctrines you never heard from me, but don't freak out about that because it's really just me talking in the future, other things I didn't. I mean, so you already have a church which has created many, many new doctrines. So in the same way, I think it's fair to say, and most, I think many mainstream scholars say it, there's also a historical drift in the case of Buddha. So if you study the life of Buddha, another very impressive figure, you have this very Spartan, this very austere teaching. And when Buddha is asked about the self, Atma, is there a self, is there a soul, he just doesn't answer the question. He said, well, that's not really what I'm going to talk about. I'm talking about something else, about, you know, your suffering. This is why you're suffering, you need to stop your suffering, and here practically is how you stop your suffering. So, and then from that historical Buddha, you get this great, this prolific creation of dogma and doctrine, which becomes very, very strongly, very adamantly, and very aggressively focused on denying the self, denying the soul, and attributing to Buddha all kinds of motives and not speaking about it. Like, this is what he really wanted to say, but he didn't say it. And so what's interesting is you have a lot of the central doctrines of later philosophical Buddhism, because if you look at Buddhism on the ground as a world religion, it was just kind of like a general religion. People wanted to go to heaven, and they worship gods and guardian angels and their forefathers and so on, and everything that everybody else was doing in Asia at the time. But if you look at philosophical Buddhism, you get these very aggressive, extremely aggressive denials of God, denials of the soul, denials of things that Buddha didn't really do. In fact, it's actually a series of interpretations of the Buddha's silence, which is quite amazing. And what was the other point I wanted to make? That so one thing that just struck me is kind of, I don't know, I wanted to throw a penalty flag or something. And that is, again, this is not about Buddha, whom I greatly admire, but in terms of some of the philosophizing that came much later about Buddha, these people, some of these people, really, they would use language a lot. They would make all kinds of arguments and make all kinds of claims. And then when they got sort of backed into a corner, because at a certain point what they were saying didn't really make sense, they would pull out their trump card, which is that, well, the truth can't be spoken in words. It can't be described in words. And then as soon as they kind of got out of that, they'd go back to using words. In fact, there was a veritable explosion of literary production. The Buddhist philosophers wrote hundreds and thousands of books. It's a very impressive thing, but so they literally wrote millions and tens of millions of words, and they go in and out of language. Like, when we want to, words count, and words are valid to defeat your teaching or path, but if you argue against what we're doing, what we do can't be described in words, so you can't argue against it. And then literally 10 seconds later, they're back attacking what you do with words. And what they attacked, of course, was the yoga system. It's sometimes it gets like a sanitized version of Indian history. But this is, people, they didn't kill each other, to their credit. They didn't really have religious wars. They didn't have inquisitions and witch trials on the scale that Europe did. They, I guess. But so it was peaceful in a sense. It was philosophical, but there were very, very heavy debates going on. So this approach to language, that you can use it to knock out everybody else, and then if you're backed into a corner philosophically, you just suddenly, language means nothing, and then you go right back on the attack. And you describe it, and in fact, and words can even be used to describe the state of nirvana. So, so in that particular, again, I want to say this over and over again, Buddha himself I consider to be an extraordinary person that I have the greatest admiration for. But a certain technical philosophy developed in which practically all of the major terms are grammatically negative. Like, for example, nirvana. Nirvana, I'm not saying it's a negative concept, but it's a negative word grammatically, in the sense that in Sanskrit, nir means without. So nirvana means without vana, vana-less. And vana, of course, means the current of material life. Anatman, another very, very key term in this philosophical tradition, was anatman, no self. There's no self. And shunyavad, emptiness, or shunyata. So absence of everything, no self, no vana. And a very strong emphasis on the fact that the world is miserable and you really need just to reject it. So I would like to contrast this with the yoga way of thinking, which is found in the Yoga Sutras, found in the Bhagavad Gita, and found in many devotional literatures. And that is that the only real problem in the world, there's only one problem really with the world, and that is all of us are more or less shoplifters. So, in the sense that we are trying to enjoy the world without first asking the really simple question, like, whose world is it? Whose world is it? Is it really available for us? Can we just kind of get our hands on it? Can we possess things? Can we try to enjoy things, exploit things? Our own body, other people's bodies, nature, you know, whatever. Or, I mean, and what is the status of the world? Where does the universe come from? And who controls it? Or what controls it? And what is ultimately our relationship with the universe? So, the yoga tradition and the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhakti devotional traditions concluded that, well, as expressed in Vedanta, ultimately in this debate with certain other philosophies like Buddhism and Jainism, and again, all the people in the debate shared many assumptions. That's why they could talk to each other, because they shared many basic assumptions. But ultimately, the philosophical argument against no self, no God, and so on, the philosophical argument against this and defending the original Vedic yoga position was found in the Vedanta tradition. So the Vedanta tradition, I'm probably you've heard of Vedanta. Veda means knowledge, unto the end, knowledge end, the end of knowledge and the summit of knowledge, and also because, anyway. So, although various people were arguing in favor of the ancient tradition, the Vedic tradition, against the idea that, as the Buddhists argued, that because words, I mean the Buddhists argued the Vedas were useless and had no authority, and so on. And there's no self to meditate on, and all this. So, although various schools and communities in India had a vested interest in arguing against this and defending, because in India, I mean, I would say basically almost any world religion, if you study world religions, there's basically two, and this is a rough generalization, but I think a useful one. There are various approaches, not just two, but one basic approach is ritual, ceremonies. You find in every religion in the world, whether it's the sacraments of Roman Catholicism, or the rituals of Hinduism, which were in fact, it's often said, it's cliche about Hinduism that it's orthopraxis. It's the right praxis, the right behavior and rituals. It's not orthodoxy, not the right philosophy. So in Judaism also, Judaism actually, and Hinduism that way, have many things in common. That's another topic for another day. And it's been pointed out, there are striking historical similarities between Hinduism and Judaism. But you can find in every religion that one approach is people believe in the power of ceremonies, rituals, certain prayers, certain procedures, ritual purity, certain kinds of offerings. If you look at Greco-Roman civilization, probably in terms of the mass of people in ancient Greece and Rome, it was really about the rituals and the purity and all that, and the ceremonies and so on. So, and then another approach is that in Sanskrit that's called karmakanda, that whole approach of through rituals and ceremonies and sacraments and so on, trying to purify your soul and get into a right relationship with God. And then there's the approach of knowledge. There's the approach of knowledge, which is that the main thing is to get a right understanding. A right understanding. To pursue wisdom. And then, of course, there's the mystic approach, which is often connected to the knowledge approach. The idea of mystic meditation, mystic experiences. So anyway, in India, at the time that Buddhism was becoming very popular, there was a huge ritual establishment. A huge. Rituals were extremely important, and a lot of the Brahmins, who really controlled the religious life in Vedic culture, they were into all these very technical, elaborate rituals, sacrifices. And so when the Buddhists came along and said that the Vedas have no value, the sacrifices and rituals prescribed in the Vedas therefore have no authority, and these sacred hymns that you guys have been preserving for thousands of years, and what is generally considered to be perhaps the greatest feat of memorization in human history. You have this huge Rig Veda, which is extremely sophisticated in its language, and thousands of verses, and they memorize the whole thing down to the technical accents, and I mean, perfectly, without writing. So it's considered one of the great feats of memorization. And so this language, the sacred language, which is, was at the center of this whole Hindu thing, and here these people come and say, your books have no authority, the language is ultimately an illusion, and the ceremonies have no power, they won't do anything for you, you're just sort of, you know, wasting good butter into the fire you could use to maybe, you know, fry up some vegetables or something. So the ritualists, who are called the Purva Mimamsa group, the Karma Mimamsa group, this Brahma group, they fought back ferociously. They had their own philosophers, and they argued very strongly that ritual is at the center of spiritual culture and so on. So they argued against the Buddhists very strongly. But the person that argued against the Buddhists that really had the greatest success and really became the most famous philosopher in Indian history was, of course, Shankara of the Vedanta tradition. And he had his position on language in which he accepted the power of the Vedic language. But then ultimately, there was a great, after Shankara, there was this tremendous spiritual renaissance in India of the bhakti movements, various types of bhakti movements, devotion, which also used the Vedanta, used the philosophy, used the arguments, and so on, but said that ultimately it's about love. The real point is not, ultimately it's not merely intellectual. Enlightenment is not merely an intellectual experience. It's ultimately about developing pure love. And the reason that pure love is at the center of our own existence is because the source of our existence possesses pure love for us. And of course, Vedanta, if you know your Vedanta, Vedanta begins with the Sanskrit sutra. We have the word suture in English, like a thread. So the word sutra, it means thread in Sanskrit. Because sutra, there's a whole genre of literature, sutra literature, which was like over the top, pithy, and condensed. So, I mean, statements which are so condensed that you really have to try to figure out, what does that mean? Because it's so condensed. And so Vedanta Sutra was that, and so then there's so many interpretations. But so the Vedanta begins the Tato Brahma Jigyasa in Sanskrit. Now, in human life, we should search for the absolute truth. That's what human life is about, searching for the highest knowledge. And the Tato Brahma Jigyasa, and the Janmadhyasya Jataha. The absolute truth is the source of everything. It's the source of everything. Because everything comes from it. It includes everything. Everything exists within it. And for that reason, it is an absolute truth, because it contains everything. It produces everything, and everything comes back to rest within it. So, ultimately, if you study the history of India, what happened is sort of this devotional yoga movement, that there was this very powerful wave, this very powerful development, that the source of everything is personal. Not in a crude anthropomorphic sense, not in a sort of a pre-philosophical silly sense, but in a very serious, very philosophically serious sense, that there is a personal God. And to be personal is to be free. To be personal is to have the power and the freedom to act, to create, to love, to be loved, to be a person, is the most precious thing that can happen to someone, is get to be a person. An individual free center of consciousness and will and knowledge and love. And that ultimately, just as you are the center of your present, of your existence, as a free, loving soul, you are the center of your own existence. There is an awareness of consciousness, but you are the center of that consciousness. Consciousness is about you. And you have the power to interact with other consciousness, and even with unconscious things. And so ultimately, there's this, just as you are the center of your physical body, you the conscious person, so there is a center, there's a conscious center of the universe. And actually, in the Vedic terms, a universe is sort of a local thing. There are trillions of universes described, and so the idea is the center of all existence. The center of all existence is that supreme personal consciousness, which is called in many ways. For example, there's a common Sanskrit term, Purushottama, the ultimate person. Uttama Purusha, Purushottama, and so on. And that because there is an infinite personal consciousness, you can enter into an infinite loving relationship. And your relationship with that infinite personal consciousness is that you are one with it, but also different, because you're a free individual. So there's, I mean, think of what any healthy relationship is. In any healthy relationship, there's a real oneness, but also you're an individual. If you lose your individuality entirely, it's called codependence. And if there's no oneness, it's sort of a state of estrangement. In other words, if you have a relationship with another person and you don't really feel in a sense like we're one, there's no oneness, then maybe you need counseling. And if you lose your individuality entirely, then maybe you need counseling. So the idea is there's we are one, all of us. We really are one, and yet all of us are free individuals. And that's what makes a super relationship. When two free individuals, two powerful, free, wise individuals agree to enter into a unity. And so, if you just study healthy relationships among us, you can understand a lot about your relationship with God. You can now put in the G word. So, even in the Yoga Sutras, for example, Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras says, Samadhi Siddhya Ishwara Pranidhanat. Samadhi is the perfection of yoga. And he says, Samadhi Siddhi, the perfection of the perfection. The Siddhi, the perfection, the success of Samadhi comes by Ishwara Pranidhana, by devotion to the Lord. So, having not had a long history of religious persecution, brutality, atrocities, and so on, they were not so shy about using this word. The word, in other words, the last point I want to make, and then I'll sort of wrap things up very quickly, you can ask any question you like. My own conclusion, having studied Western civilization a bit, is that just as there is a psychological condition called post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, that if someone, like, often, for example, people that have been in combat, it's being talked about a lot in the news, it's post-traumatic, or if a child or even an older person witnesses some really like terrible thing, like you know, the death of someone they care about, some violence. And so there's a trauma to the mind. And then post-traumatic, after that trauma, after the trauma's over, the event isn't happening anymore, but there's still this real stress, this anxiety, and it's a disorder because it creates various conditions, like, for example, hypersensitivity, because it's like, you know, it's like the typical cartoon where some guys come back from combat and, you know, he hears a car backfire and he dies for cover. So, in fact, that's one of the main things people are talking about now, this whole this public scandal about the military not taking care of people after they did their thing. And so post-traumatic stress disorder, it leads to hypersensitivity and withdrawal. Interesting, like someone's hypersensitive, but they withdraw precisely because they're afraid it may happen again. And so my conclusion is this, which I'll share with you. If you study the history of our civilization, Western America is just like sort of like, you know, like a cultural colony of Europe. So if you study the history of Western civilization, there's absolutely no question, no doubt, that Western civilization underwent many horrifically traumatic experiences. I mean, when you just sort of walk out the door of your little medieval cottage and you see people, maybe your neighbors, being burned alive in front of you, perhaps because they're witches, perhaps because they just made subtle theological mistakes. In Oxford, England, great college town, there's a monument right in the middle of the town, right in the middle of old Oxford, there's a monument to three Oxford professors, theology professors, who were burned alive at the stake by the Queen of England for the simple reason that she was Catholic and they were Protestants. Now, it could be said in their defense that they became Protestants and got their appointments at Oxford at a time when the British monarch was Protestant. So that's what you were supposed to do. But then The old monarch died, the new monarch came in, and the new monarch was Catholic, so everyone had to suddenly convert. I mean, the whole country had to convert, and those that didn't, some of them were burned alive. So, I mean, I don't want to go into all the details, but the Inquisitions, we've all heard of the Inquisitions. If you actually read something about the history of it, it's traumatic just to read about it. You had some of the most materially clever people in Western civilization as a full-time job, thinking up the most cruel, excruciating, sick ways to cause pain to other human beings. And that was basically what they did for a living. So, Western Europe, Western civilization, has been traumatized. And I would say that among many people, especially actually educated people, I would say that on a civilization level, on a societal level, we are suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And you see it in discussions of religion, in discussions of God, hypersensitivity and withdrawal. One of the ways this hypersensitivity manifests is that because the claim was made for so many centuries that this is the only way, and if you don't agree, something very, very bad is going to happen to you on your way out of the planet. So, because of that, the very act of claiming that this is a highest truth has become completely unrespectable. It doesn't even matter whether your claim is reasonable or not. It doesn't matter whether you are, let's say, subscribed to principled inclusivism, in the sense that you're actually inclusive in your views, but based on principles. And based on what to you are reasonable principles, you feel there's a certain hierarchy of understanding so that wisdom can grow, and you claim that ultimately something, whatever, this or that is the highest wisdom. That act itself, just claiming, even reasoning your way to the conviction that this is the highest truth, has really become highly stigmatized, because many people feel that, oh my God, you want to take us back to the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages. But what comes next? You know, Inquisitions, or burn people alive? So just open discussion, free open discussion, where people can say and make arguments that this is the highest truth, or this is the highest conception of God, has become sort of very frightening, unrespectable. It's considered almost like rude and offensive, and like, you don't get it, and everyone has their own way. So what I would like to say is that I think in order for us to re-spiritualize this horrific consumerist civilization that we live in, I saw this bumper sticker in Athens, Ohio. I just wanted to share with you. I already told you. I thought it was really funny. It said, how did it go? If you're not nice to America, we're going to bring democracy to your country. So anyway, So to re-spiritualize our society, I think we have to be willing to engage in reasonable, tolerant, mutually respectful discussion of things. And the idea that just whatever you think is fine for you, I mean, none of us really believe that, because then we have to endorse religious terrorism, no matter who's doing it, you know, this group or that group. So, I mean, none of us really, if we're pushed far enough, are going to say that whatever anybody believes is good for them, if that's what they believe. I mean, we're not really going to endorse atrocities and murderous persecutions, and yet some people believe that God is calling them to do that. Some people really believe that God wants them to do that. So in this day and age, no thinking person, I think, can say that whatever anybody believes is good for them if it works for them. There does have to be some kind of reasonable, objective, non-dogmatic, non-fanatical criteria. So anyway, as far as language, I'll end there that I think on reasonable ground, I think language is, I think the original yogis and the original sages in that culture, I think they had it right, that language is ultimately and originally divine. And it is, there's no greater gift that we've received that we can communicate. There's no limit to the creative and spiritual possibilities of language. That the words may not always be the experience itself, but a good map is a great thing to have. For example, when I was driving down to Atlanta today, about 30 miles out, everybody just stopped. It's just like, someone had the really like bright idea of doing construction somewhere. And so about 30 miles out of Atlanta, we just stopped. And I tried an alternative route, and that stopped. And I tried a third alternative route, and that stopped. And I began to wonder, like, am I going to get to Atlanta today? And then I pulled out my trusty map, and I was able to figure out a way to get around it. In case you're interested, if you're ever coming from the north, through down 75, I just sort of cut down 92 to Douglasville, then down to 20. What I mean to say is the map wasn't the land. I think I understood that the map was not Georgia. I didn't really have that problem, like, oh my God, I think this is really Georgia. But it was a good map. And so a great map is a great thing to have. And language can be a map. And I think that every terrain can be mapped. I think that every philosophy can be mapped. And people that say can't talk about it, first of all, they always do talk about it when it's to their advantage, an argument. They just stop talking about it when they're backed into a corner. And secondly, I just don't believe it. I really think that words are divine, and that even if the word isn't the thing itself, you can give reasonable people a reasonable description of where they're going, and not simply tell them, you should go here, but I can't tell you what it is. And the final thing about language is that it can be the experience. I mean, what happens? What if, for example, you fall in love with someone? What if you fall in love with someone and it's not at all clear they're falling in love with you? You know, worst case scenario. Where you are deeply falling in love with someone, and whether it's their natural reserve or maybe someone else, whatever, but they're simply not apparently reciprocating. And then let's say you go through all kinds of stuff and whatever, and pray to Dr. Phil. And then finally the day comes when the other person says, I love you, and they really mean it. And they actually, in some very special place and moment, the other person reveals that they actually do love you as you love them. I mean, to say those words are meaningless, you know, means nothing, and just words, no. When that person says those words, and when you hear those words, you have an extremely powerful experience. And the words really don't get in the way of the experience. The words are serving that experience. They're facilitating that experience. And so, again, I don't think we should give up on the world. We shouldn't give up on words. We shouldn't try to exploit it, get stuck in it. But language and the world itself are divine and beautiful if we just learn not to exploit these things and to take them in a healthy spirit as gifts, meant to be used to offer back to the person that gave the gift. And I'll just end with one last little, this is my seventh ending, but I will end with some very beautiful words that come from a festival for Saint Cecilia. Do you know anything about Saint Cecilia? In the 17th century, roughly, in Europe, there was a belief that Saint Cecilia was the patron saint of the artists. By artists, I mean poets, composers of music, and other artists. And so every year there would be a special festival for Saint Cecilia. And the greatest composers, the greatest artists, visual artists, and the music, poets, composers, all these great artists would get together and they'd have a festival in honor of St. Cecilia. And the festival included a sacred service because they didn't have their secular, non-secular, you know, it was just life itself was somehow seen as involved with God, all of life in a holistic way. And so in England, I think in 1693 particularly, there was a great English composer, considered the greatest English composer of the 17th century, named Henry Purcell. I don't know if any of you know Henry Purcell, but I think he writes just incredibly exquisite music. He died very young, actually, at the age of 36, I think. But so he was the most prominent composer in England at that time, and so he was asked to write the music for the St. Cecilia's Day festival. And one of the greatest poets in England wrote some words, and he put it to music. And so that's why we still have it, because the music is so gorgeous that the whole festival has come down to us, and we have all the songs they sang. And he himself, by the way, was a virtuoso singer. And so in one of the songs they performed for that festival, and all the greatest composers and poets in England gathered for this festival, one of the songs, the words are, and I'm somewhat paraphrasing, that this melody, this music with every note is repaying to heaven melody it lent. In other words, the philosophy was, and you find this in Bhagavad Gita also, by the way, this exact same philosophy, you find it in Renaissance in Europe, in England, that the music we make, whatever we create, the love we have, everything is a gift coming from heaven or God, however you say it. And Purcell's, the idea was that with this music, every note is an attempt to repay heaven for the melody that heaven lent, that we are being given these things, and we take them and offer them back, and this creates in Sanskrit what is called a chakra, a circle, or a cycle, or a wheel. And you know, the Buddhists talk about the Dharma wheel and so on. So in the Bhagavad Gita, this wheel, this cycle, is that we're receiving all these gifts, the gifts of life, the gift of consciousness, the gift of creativity, the gift of love, and we take all these gifts and just offer them back, including language, the gift of language. And that forms a circle, a cycle, a wheel. And there's this beautiful verse in the Gita where Krishna says, evam pravartitam chakra, which I'll translate this very literally. A wheel has been made to turn. A wheel has been made to turn. And actually the word pra indicates like a wheel turning progressively. A progressive wheel has been made to turn. And namu vartiyatiha jaha, but one who does not keep the wheel turning. One who does not keep the wheel turning, aghayo, their life is an offense to the universe. Indriyaramo, because they're taking these gifts, and rather than offering them back, they're just trying to exploit them. They're using these gifts not to make an offering, but just to exploit their own bodies, to use these gifts just to exploit them. And then mogam partha jivati, and such a person lives in vain. Because real elevation, real happiness, knowledge comes by entering into this cycle, and you have to keep it turning. As we receive gifts, we have to offer them back. And that was exactly the philosophy, not only in the Gita, that you find in this beautiful piece put to music by Henry Purcell around 1693. So this was a planetary understanding. If you know your Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, no respectable person in Homer ever eats or drinks anything without first offering it. You don't just eat and drink things, you have to offer them to the source, and then you take them. So even eating and drinking is a yoga process which involves you in this cosmic cycle of reciprocation with the powers of the universe, even eating and even drinking water. So, language, yay language. Anyway, so, any questions on these points? Yes, please.
You've talked about Sanskrit a lot tonight, and then with, you know, different language. Even if we speak English, it's hard to portray our feelings and necessarily get across our thoughts and emotions. And you wish you had that right word and it doesn't exist, something like that. In your study of Sanskrit or any other language, is there a language that you link with personally that makes you feel passionate and more connected with God, with others, because it embodies more than just the words themselves, but a whole philosophy behind right. how that language or what was important at that time, like Sanskrit being extinct basically now, except for those studying it. Was there something unique about that language? Or was there a certain word that embodied a whole thought process that takes us a whole, you know, 200 pages to say that they say in one word?
Right.
Is there something about that language that makes you feel passion, connection to God more than English?
You raised several interesting points. I think just in terms of passion, sometimes I speak Italian, it's like... But anyway, I want to address, you raised several interesting points. I'm going to take them somewhat in order. First of all, is not finding the right word. I'm actually, among other things, I don't want to say I'm a writer, but I write. I think it's kind of pretentious to say I am a writer, but I do write. I'm just finishing a novel. And I believe there's an art to language. And that sometimes we can't find the right word, sometimes it's because we haven't really worked at it. It's like, if you're playing musical instruments, a keyboard, sometimes you just can't really express yourself. But it's not really the limitation of music, it's just I may not have put the time in and really studied music enough. So I wouldn't give up on language. I think that if we cultivate the art of language and really invest in it, language will repay our investment, and language will be good to us. And more we will be able to find the right word. Then as far as the point of which language, Sanskrit is an extremely elegant language. I remember when I was at Harvard, I had one professor who had studied, he did his graduate studies at Stanford, and he started out in classic Greek and Latin, and he switched to Sanskrit. And he found it to be the most elegant language. And also Sir William Jones was in 1790, he was the governor of East India, they have the East India Trading Company, and a linguist actually, who really brought Sanskrit to the attention of the Western world in a big way. And he studied Sanskrit, he said he found it to be the most elegant language, more than Greek, ancient Greek and Latin, which was saying a lot, because those were the foundations of Western erudition. And so the word Sanskrita, the Sanskrit language, by the way, doesn't call itself Sanskrit. And there hardly, I don't know of any book which says that this language is called Sanskrit. I mean, no ancient book. But the word Sanskrita in Sanskrit means refined or perfected. And so the fact that it came to be called Sanskrit was recognition within the tradition that this is a very, very highly refined language. So in that sense, it's very elegant, it's very precise. It also has incredible scope for ambiguity. If you want to do like esoteric, multivalent, ambivalence, there's nothing like Sanskrit. For the simple reason that I'll try to put this very simply. The ends of words, the letters, the sounds, can merge into the beginnings of other words phonetically, so that they sort of like bleed together so you get a new sound. So the same word can mean a thing or not the thing, or like someone does something or doesn't do it. And so there's like unlimited scope for ambiguity in Sanskrit. However, I mean, let's say apart from its great refinement, because it's an extremely sophisticated language with thousands of years of practice using language to express spiritual things. And yet somehow, despite all that, I tend to think, having personally like learned many, many languages and spoken many languages, and it's true, like say if you speak Italian or Portuguese or French or German, it's like it just somehow does something to you. But or English. or Sanskrit. But ultimately, I would say ultimately, language, almost any language, any normal language can really kind of do the trick. Because I think the power ultimately is in the concepts and in the reality. And I think, I would say it's a gift of God that, like, people in every language fall in love. In every language, people fall madly in love. And they express themselves to each other. And if you learn any language, you'll find incredibly exquisite poetry in that language. And so there is kind of a special thing about Sanskrit. I don't want to say there's nothing special about it. And in a sense, because the people that sort of expressed the concepts also spoke Sanskrit and wrote Sanskrit, so they kind of used words which, so it kind of had that advantage of the original jargon. But even in Sanskrit, I would say that if you study, let's say, like Buddhist philosophy as expressed in Sanskrit, or Vedanta philosophy expressed in Sanskrit, or all the different philosophies that are expressed in Sanskrit, they all use a lot of jargon. They all use a lot of jargon. And so it's not strictly literal. They all use words in special ways. Just like Western philosophy has a special jargon. So I think Sanskrit is special in that sense, but ultimately, I think language is very powerful, and language is divine. And every language on earth can function spiritually. And if you really know what you're talking about, you really understand the idea, and you know the language well enough, I think you can really communicate it in a very powerful way. Like myself, having studied Indian philosophy or yoga philosophy in English and also being able to read the Sanskrit, I think ultimately the spiritual power is there. And having translated the same philosophies into other languages, which I've done, and having to find the right words. I sort of founded this publishing thing in Latin America, where we actually millions of books were printed and distributed in Spanish and Portuguese, and I personally worked with the translators, like searching through all the Spanish dictionaries, like, how do you really say this in Spanish, or how do you say this in Portuguese, and so on. And so, again, after all that experience, Sanskrit, English, and other languages, I think that language is wonderful. And that Sanskrit has a certain special, I think it deserves a certain special status because of what it's done and what it is. But at the same time, I think languages in general, if you know them well enough and you know what you mean well enough, I think almost any language can be a marvelous spiritual vehicle. Yes, sir.
In your experience, do you have any thoughts on what you walked away with as you were, quote unquote, swimming in the language of participation compared to swimming in the language of invention?
Invention versus participation. Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Like, a lot of what you were speaking tonight, if I were to step into it, it would be an invention for me. But if you and I were just talking about, you know, this room and the trees outside, we'd be sharing that, participating in it.
Right.
And I wonder if you have any experiences like that as you were swimming through the different kinds of languages.
It's a very interesting question. Sort of made me think about something I never really thought about. It's a good thing. To me, reality is a world in which, as Krishna says in the Gita, God or Krishna, it's just a word for God, is within everything, and everything is within God.
Yeah.
And so, now, in Sanskrit, they make an obvious and necessary distinction. The Buddhists made this distinction. Actually, maybe they get the credit. The Buddhists, philosophical Buddhists, made this distinction. The Shankara and the Vedanta people kind of used it, and now it's become sort of a standard thing. And that is, sometimes we use language. And sometimes we express ourselves in a sense which they would call vyavaharika. And the word vyavaharika simply means ordinary social intercourse. I'll give you an example. And sometimes paramarthika, we're talking about the highest truth. For example, let's say from the paramarthika standpoint, spiritual standpoint, I accept what Krishna says in the Gita, that Najayate Mriyate Vakadacha, the soul is never born and never dies. The soul has always existed and always will exist. So let's say I'm filling out an application to get a credit card, to get in some school, and they say, like, date of birth, I put, I was never born. Place of birth, I was never born. And parents' name, you know, who are my parents? I'm the eternal soul. You know, like Jesus said, let the dead bury the dead. So, in other words, you're obviously not going to get the credit card. Or you're not going to get into whatever institution. So, now, back then, people also had to fill out applications. I mean, not exactly, but it's interesting because when we fill out an application, typically the first thing is last name. And that was exactly the first line in ancient Vedic applications, because they have this word gotra, which means your lineage, like who your forebears, your ancestors, where do you come from? Because they had this very organized society. And so that was the first question, last name. That was the first question. So, and you had to apply for things, jobs. I mean, even in ancient times, you had to go and say, I'd like this job. So they made this distinction that sometimes we're talking in sort of an ordinary, conventional sense just to get by in the world, because the world appears to us in a certain way, and all spiritual paths basically say that the appearance is not the ultimate reality. That when we are in sort of ordinary, unenlightened, just day-to-day consciousness, the appearance, the way the world appears to us, is not the last word on the world. There's something more, something deeper, something more significant about the world which you can't see just on the surface. So therefore, sometimes we have to use language because we have to skate the surface sometimes. I mean, sometimes you've got to make your way on the surface. But then you want to have a spiritual life. You want to have wisdom. You want to see things as they really are. And when you're doing that thing, you can't just use the surface language, because it's okay, now we're having a serious philosophical conversation. So you have these two levels of language. And ultimately, we should come to the point where, even though we do the ordinary language for ordinary things, like, you know, how are you, fine? And sometimes, I remember the early days of the Hare Krishna, like, it got very zany. Or it got and stayed very zany in some ways, but I remember that, like, sometimes, we'd be, like, really young, you know, 19, 20 years old, and just have this powerful conversion experience. And you'd be out on the street, and some reporter come and say, where are you from? The spiritual world. You know, but we've fallen down into the material. Yeah, okay, that's fine, that's your policy. Where are you from? No, I'm really from this. And, you know, we just couldn't answer simple questions like that. Anyway, but since then, our brains solidified physiologically, and so we do have to be able just to deal with the world, but we should get to the point where even if you look out the window at the trees or just look at the walls, you really are seeing God. You really do see God or Krishna within everything, and you see everything within God, and you can talk about it authentically. You're not just being, like, philosophical. Someone says, well, okay, I don't want to hear your doctrine now. Let's talk about the room as it really is. But we have to come to the point where authentically, that's really what we see, that we really do see God everywhere. By the way, the word Krishna, since we're talking about language, Krish is an ancient Sanskrit root which means to attract, to pull. And so, because God is infinitely attractive, not just infinitely threatening, but infinitely attractive, infinitely beautiful, therefore Krish, and Na is an abbreviation of a word I'm sure you've all heard, Ananda, as in Anandini. And so, Nanda or ananda, the prefix of, refers to pleasure or bliss. And so the non-Krishna's brief. So Krishna means that God is infinitely beautiful and pleasing, and also infinitely delightful, source of pleasure. The word Rama, by the way, Sanskrit root rum, which I always say is not the Caribbean beverage. Rum is an ancient Sanskrit root, R-A-M, which means, again, to enjoy, to give pleasure. And so Rama means source of pleasure, etymologically. Iti, in fact, it said, Ramante yogino anantes, and so on. Iti Rama padena sa, that the Absolute is called Rama because the Absolute is the source of all, of infinite pleasure. So, well, there you go.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. So, anything else? Yes? Don't introduce me again.
Well, I was just thinking about the commentaries of the Buddha, of this incident in which the Buddha was asked about the nature of the soul and he was silent.
Yes.
And how, inevitably the commentaries come up with explanations like, it's too complicated to be described in words.
Well, actually what they say is, and this is very interesting, the standard commentary, going back to ancient times, standard commentary that you'll always hear, is that Buddha didn't answer it because the very question was phrased in such a way that any answer would have been misleading. Because if you say there is a self, Buddha wouldn't say that because there's not a self. Again, this is not Buddha, by the way. These are his later self-appointed spokespersons. He couldn't say there is a self because, of course, there's not. And he couldn't say there's not a self because that might imply that there used to be, but there isn't now. And they go through this whole thing. Now, my answer to that, again, not talking about religious doctrines, but just doing what Buddhists always did, and that is engaging in free and open philosophical discussion. They have a long history of this. I would say to them, look, if you guys can explain why Buddha kept silent, and say, well, didn't say this because that would mislead you in this way. He didn't say that because it would mislead you in that way. If you can tell us that now, and we understand it, and Buddhists have been telling the world that for thousands of years, and no one's confused because they explain it, why couldn't Buddha explain it? I mean, if you can explain it in such a way that no one ever gets confused, why couldn't he explain it in such a way that no one ever got confused? So the obvious point is, it can be explained in a way that no one gets confused, because you've been doing it for thousands of years. So if that's what he meant, why didn't he just say it? And it reminds me of this great Sanskrit line I love from an ancient text called the Bhagavatam. Kim na bruyur vidurjati. Why didn't they say it if they actually knew it? Or if they actually understood it, why didn't they just say it? So that's my point. Personally, I love the historical Buddha. I have great admiration. In fact, within the devotional traditions, Buddha is accepted as an avatar, as an incarnation. He's not respected. He's accepted as an incarnation of God. So, but the later interpretations, which became very aggressively and just very aggressively and heavily, no self, no soul, no God, in a way that, in a language that Buddha never really used personally, is sort of, it's a different thing in my view. I'm sorry, did I?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, follow.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, well, yeah, one thing is maybe we just have to find the appropriate language to describe what we're experiencing. But other than that, I was thinking of the power of silence, or within language, the use of pauses,
yes.
The use of silence within language, and also, sometimes you say, like, it's about the notes he didn't play, or it's about the words that he didn't say. So I was just thinking about that. The use of
but it's still about language. As you say, it's still within language.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, for example, my favorite composer, I have to admit, is George Friedrich Handel.
Yes. Absolutely. Handel's work.
Yeah, water music, fire. Yeah, we'll talk later about that. So, and I play Handel too. That's sort of like my serious hobby, playing. And so, he has the most incredible pause. There's one thing, if you know the, the last piece in the Messiah Oratorio, that's one where it has the Hallelujah. There was a whole thing he did, first performed in Dublin, actually. I saw the place where he first performed in Dublin. As a work of charity. And so it's many different pieces. I think over 30. I forget the exact number. But in the last one, the Amen, the last piece, he does this fantastic false ending where, which is sort of a technique in the Baroque where, you know, it's leading up to this great musical climax at the very end of the piece. Like, this is it, the Amen. Everyone knows this is the last piece. And then it looks like it's over. And it pauses, and then suddenly the soprano, you know, a female voice comes in, you know, way up there, and it's just like, oh my God, it's just a total knockout. I can't say I don't know how to describe it, because I'll just undermine everything I just said. But, I find it thrilling. I mean, I find it just like electrifies me in my soul, just, you know, because it's sort of, it's ended. And it's a very conscious false ending. It's sort of like ends sort of in a typical Baroque way, and then it stops, and there's silence, and then this girl comes in, this high note, and it's just, anyway. You'll see if you listen to it. So yes, pauses and silence and what was not spoken are very powerful, but within a context in which there is communication. Not where ultimately at the end there's only silence. That's a very different thing. I think did you someone here wanted to ask something? Well, thank you all very much. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So I hope you like that.